We know the expression race card. When someone is accused of pulling one, it means they're assigning racism where it doesn't belong. But our next guest wants to draw attention to something else in the pack he calls the violence card. We want to spend a few minutes today with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library, also author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Dr. Muhammad, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called Playing the Violence Card, and this is, of course, in the wake of the killing of an unarmed black teen, Trayvon Martin, by George Zimmerman, the white Hispanic who did have a gun. What do you mean by violence card?
Well, it means that in a moment of national outrage and protest about the all-too-familiar killing of an unarmed black person, either by a citizen or at the hands of police officers, there's a kind of response, and that response is that, well, even if the facts hold up to be the case that this is a case of a trigger-happy police officer or vigilante violence, it's really just a blip on the racial radar of America. The most common cause of the deaths of black men are the killing by another black man. And so the sense is that this is not an opportunity for national conversation, but to retreat to the space that, well, this is really black people's problem, that is violence, and they have to fix it on their own.
Well, and in the national debate that we've been hearing in the last couple of weeks, you say you've heard this violence card pulled. By whom?
George Stephanopoulos had George F. Will as a regular roundtable guest about the Trayvon Martin killing, and his immediate response is that the root fact is about 150 black men are killed every week in this country, and 94% of them are by other black men. The point is that this is an isolated incident. The real problem about violence is black men. Juan Williams had a similar response in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that effectively criticized black leadership and civil rights leadership in the person of Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, and saying, where are the marchers for the young black murder victims that occurs in this country? In fact, half of all murder victims are black, and the vast majority are killed by other black men. And so, again, it was this voice of repudiating this notion that we have a racial crisis in America, when really, to the extent that there's a violence crisis, it's a black people's violence problem. Shelby Steele, a conservative author, made similar claims in a follow-up Wall Street Journal piece that was after Juan Williams's.
Well, so you're not disputing any of these statistics that these people are pointing to. You're saying that that when they point to these statistics, and when we hear the phrase black-on-black crime, it's saying, don't look here at Trayvon Martin. It's saying, look over there at that.
Well, it's a way of taking the criticism and the frustration and in some cases the outrage of a dead black person, and saying, well, if you really do care about dead black people, then why are you focused on George Zimmerman? Or even in the case of, and we haven't heard this because the Tulsa cases are so explicitly egregious, and so you don't hear people sort of pulling the violence card in that instance. But in effect, it's saying if the issue is dead black men, then your primary focus should be on all of the black men who die at the hands of other black men. I mean, that's the violence card. But aside from pointing to that reality, which is a grave reality, it contributes to, one, the pathologization of black people as exceptional, when in fact intraracial murder is true of every single community everywhere in the world. Most people die at the hands of people who are categorized as like them, and indeed the vast majority of people die at the hands of people who they know.
Well, let's pick up on that. You mentioned Tulsa. That's, of course, two suspects who are alleged to have literally gone and looked for black people to shoot and kill. There was also the case in Mississippi, a young white man who was charged with a hate crime for looking for a black person to kill, and he did. But this idea of saying, look away from those crimes and instead look at black-on-black crime, author Edward Wyckoff Williams wrote recently in the online magazine The Root, don't white people kill each other too? He points out 84% of white people who are murdered by other white people. And so if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying it's making it something that just blacks do when you point to black-on-black crime, but it also makes it, what, their problem, not society's?
That's correct. There is no language or discourse about white-on-white violence. So that move in and of itself stigmatizes black people. It associates blackness with violence and or criminality, rather than it being a social problem of homicide, which exists in all communities. Really, it boils down to a numbers game. Simply because there are disproportionately higher rates of murder in black people, all of a sudden it is a racial reflection, evidence of black people's pathologies, as opposed to in white America, where it's a much larger pool of people, and yet a huge sample of dead bodies that no one ever claims is evidence of white-on-white violence. The other part of that is, of course, that by labeling it a racial trait or racial phenomenon, it lets the larger society off the hook as having any responsibility for actually intervening, and becomes a kind of self-reinforcing narrative that black people really don't care about fixing their own problems. The only time that they get worked up is to blame white people in the case of a white person killing a black person.
And you say this is all as opposed to other times in history when there were alarming statistics and society did do something about it. It had to do with white-on-white crimes in the crime waves of the 1890s and 1930s.
Sure. So this is a period of the Progressive Era when a million immigrants arrived to the United States between 1900 and 1914, and oftentimes were confined and limited to very impoverished inner-city communities. Those communities had the similar earmarkings of what segregated, impoverished communities look like today. And consequently, there were also high rates of youth violence, so much so that the juvenile court system, the very infrastructure of how we deal with young people today, was established in Chicago in 1899, and Jane Addams was one of the foremost social workers and community activists of that period. In a nutshell, she marshaled public and private resources to address the problem. She helped to pursue child welfare labor laws. She helped to pursue political reforms for communities where corrupt police officers would allow drug dealing. In other words, she said that the problem of violence in these communities is not for them to fix alone.
You write that under Chicago's Jane Addams, the violent immigrant ghettos were filled with social workers, police reformers, exactly what her contemporary Harvard economist William Ripley wanted. He said, these new immigrants are ignorant with a disposition to violence. But then he added, that was precisely the argument for helping them, because the health of the nation depends on their vitality. But Dr. Mohammed, pick up there. You know, what do you say to people who ask, isn't the government doing the same thing today with social workers, welfare, food stamps, doing for poor blacks what Jane Addams did in Chicago for poor immigrants?
I would say too little, too late. The irony is that Hull House, her premier social work agency, segregated African Americans within that space. They were limited to a few hours on a couple of days of the week, emblematic of social work in that era that effectively redlined African Americans out of that. The very foundation that helped immigrants to become Americans left African Americans out, not just out of social work, but they were redlined out of the New Deal, and they were redlined out of suburbanization that happened in the period of the 1940s through the 1960s. By the time we get to the war on poverty, it lasts roughly 8 years, and then we get the war on drugs. In other words, we've not had a recent period, that is, over the last 50 years, where there weren't competing debates about the origins of black poverty and crime, in spite of what you describe as an infrastructure. I work with many of those practitioners, and the number one complaint that those social workers will tell you is that they are under-resourced. They are constantly fighting for the dollars. But let me tell you one other thing. Police officers were made accountable in the Progressive Era to the politics of compassion that was necessary to destigmatize and give those kids a second chance. Cops became frontline social workers in ways that is completely opposite to the way the policing functions today.
I'm sure there are some police who would argue that, but it's easy to see how police in that era, probably immigrants themselves, and did not see the community they were working with as the other and all the complications that come from that. But I just want to swing back to, you know, where we started, which is, as you say, conservative commentators pulling what you call the violence card. In other words, pointing to statistics about black violence against other blacks to sort of maybe swing the attention away from something like the Trayvon Martin killing and absolve society from feeling they have to do anything about it. isn't there a possibility, given some of the statistics today, that some of these commentators, Juan Williams, for instance, come to mind, are genuinely concerned about this, are not trying to take attention away from one thing, but trying to draw attention to another?
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't attempt to get inside the mind and to somehow tease out motivation. What I would say is that the argument ultimately upholds the political and economic status quo and says effectively that the problems that face Black Americans, whether they're violence or whether they're poverty, are cultural problems. And until Black people get their stuff together, until they literally pull their pants up, their problems won't change. And that simply is not sufficient to the challenge that should be met. It did not attend to the problem of the immigrants of an earlier period. It did not attend to the problems of working class white Americans in the 1930s. Indeed, no group of white Americans since the period after the Civil War have been asked to solve similar social problems as a cultural response. Crime statistics have been part of the stigmatization of Blackness and crime. The statistics were intended in the use of immigrants to point out their class inequality, their victimization in an industrializing economy that benefited the elite at the expense of the working poor. And in the case of African Americans, the crime statistics were used as a simple measure of their inferiority and really proof, as Southerners were very interested in arguing, that Black people needed to be segregated.
We're talking to Khalil Gibran Muhammad, quite thought-provoking. And Dr. Muhammad, I can't let you go without mentioning a couple of things because your name is going to be very familiar. Your father was the Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer for the New York Times, Oshir Muhammad. Your great-grandfather was Elijah Muhammad, one of the leaders of the Nation of Islam, who early on called for a separate nation for blacks, famously, you know, saying blacks should move away from the blue-eyed devils. But then he was said to moderate that tone and focus on self-help among blacks. I just wonder, I mean, talk about you can't read somebody's mind, but would your great-grandfather, as you seem to be saying, be calling for an infusion into the communities, the same kind of Jane Addams did? Or would he be saying, we have to go it alone, you know, maybe even in a funny way, agreeing with George Will, saying this is the black community has to take care of this problem?
My great-grandfather, if he were trapped in 1975 and applying that mindset to 2012, I think that he would see George Zimmerman's behavior as Exhibit A in a long line of violent acts committed by non-blacks towards blacks and evidence that black people can't live among whites with any safety and that they have to retreat to their own communities and do for themselves.
Having heard everything you've said, if your assessment of all this is true.
Sure.
One of the saddest things is that in delaying addressing the problems of the ghettoized African Americans post-Civil War, mm-hmm. one of the other effects is that you have a lot of white Americans who are tired of hearing about it because they feel they keep hearing about it, and then, as you've pointed out, nothing was done, as it was with the immigrant communities, so there's almost a fatigue about it.
That's exactly right. And when you talk about racial fatigue, there was racial fatigue in 1914 amongst one of the most liberal social workers of that time period saying, we can't do anything for these people. Never mind the fact that Plessy versus Ferguson had just been passed, you know, 20 years before, and it was the age of segregation. Mm-hmm. So what you describe in terms of the pessimistic reaction to what I've described was pessimistic 100 years ago, but we've got to get past the pessimism. We've got to buck up and say, we've got to get this right, because every generation has grown tired of having to deal with the race problem.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library, also author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Dr. Muhammad, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me on.